In today's episode, we're talking about fandom and what we can learn from Disney and religions.
From Engagement, I'm David Millay, and this is Flip the Switch.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Flip the Switch, where we sit down with leaders in customer experience and employee experience, and we try to figure out what are the trends that they're paying attention to? What are the experiments that they're running? What are the principles that have helped guide them to success throughout their career? Then we take all those insights and we apply them to the world of sports and entertainment. Now, to be fair, going forward, we're probably going to apply it a little bit less to sports and entertainment and a little bit more broadly to other industries. But let's be real, we've done 120 of these episodes or so. We're always going to have that aspect where we teach back to sports and entertainment. That's our bread and butter. So that being said, I want to jump into this episode with Jody Eichler-Levine, and it is super interesting. Katie and our team said it was one of the best episodes we've done in a long, long time. Now, to be fair, I talk a lot in this episode. So if you don't like my voice, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast at all. But especially this episode, I'm definitely chiming in a little bit more because we are talking about religion and Disney, and specifically kind of like the religious aspects of Disney. And what we're going to do is we're going to dissect some of the different frameworks that Disney and religion use to create evangelists of their brand, whether that be Christianity, Judaism, or Disney, and so that you can actually take some of those concepts and figure out how you can adapt and apply that to your organization so that you can create fanatics or fanatical fans of your organization. So to give you a little bit more background on Jody, she is the Berman Professor of Jewish Civilization and an Associate Professor of Religion Studies at Lehigh University. Now, we first found her on a Twitter thread where she was going in depth talking about the kind of religious nature of Disney and why we find adults that are just almost like weirdly addicted to Disney. We call them Disney-philes oftentimes. But she says that that is really because there are a lot of similarities between classic religion and Disney. So some of the courses that Jody teaches, just so you can kind of get an idea of where we're going to pull from in this episode. So she teaches, back in fall 2020, she taught a class called Sex, Gender, and Jews. Another one, Religion of Disney Corp. Another one, American Gods and Monsters. Jewish and African American Children's Literature. Jews in the Broadway Musical. Religion and Science Fiction. Judaism and comic books, religion and fantasy literature. So constantly taking some of these core aspects of religion and the core aspects of what drives popular culture, combining them together. And so throughout this episode, we are just going to distill different frameworks, different tactics. You're going to probably see a lot of different things that you always known have been important to you, but you've never known why. And Jody's going to unpack that for us. So without further ado, let's jump into this episode with Jody Eichler-Levine. Jody, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
We have never had a religious studies professor on the show, so I can honestly say you are the first person to come from that background. But on the show, we're always trying to bring diverse thought into the space. So really excited to just jump in and explore this topic with you.
Delighted to be here. I'm a religion professor, but I teach a lot of students from the business school. So this will be a lot of fun.
Awesome. So to give everybody a little bit of context as to why we set this episode up, Jody had a really cool Twitter thread on kind of like the religious aspects of Disney and how a lot of people that we refer to maybe as Disney-philes, at least we have on the show here, people that really love the brand of Disney, why that it almost like embodies certain elements of religion and how organizations can kind of learn from religion to really adapt and make sure that they're creating evangelists almost of their brand. So let's talk about some of the projects that you're working on. I know you're writing a book right now. Why don't you talk to us about kind of how you first became fascinated with Disney?
Right. So aside from being a teenager who went to Disney World and jokingly called it the pilgrimage each year, I really became interested in studying this as an academic hobby. When I first revisited the parks as an adult in 2016, my daughter was five, and there was a moment at Chef Mickey's where she had no cognitive dissonance between eating her Mickey Mouse macaroni and cheese, which she loved. And, you know, 5 minutes later, here comes Mickey, and she gives Mickey the biggest hug. And as a religious studies scholar, I said, this looks kind of like a totem animal, right? This is something that you revere, but you also consume. And that's something we see in all kinds of religious societies. And between that and also revisiting the parks as an adult, really noticing the kind of energy and charge around, say, the time the fireworks go off in a different way. The other thing that happened in 2016 was Moana. And again, as a parent, I was going to the movies to take my daughter there, but I still loved Disney. And there's a lot of deep, powerful stuff in Moana about relatives and ancestors that parallels so many religious traditions. So that's when it started, but I really started to work on it in 2019 as a project.
Incredible. All right. There's already so many things I want to go into, like this aspect of having something that we revere, but also consume at the same time. There's so many different areas, but maybe we start here. What do you see really kind of like the biggest parallels between religion and fan culture, maybe from an overarching level, a thematic level, before we go into the details?
Yeah. So at a structural level, there are three. Number one is story, story, story. Walt Disney Company in their mission says they are a storytelling company. It's what they do. And stories are what hold, I almost never say all religions, but stories hold almost all religions together. Number two, ritual, ritual, ritual. The embodied practices, the repeated practices in both religious traditions and Disney World are so, and I should add, not just Disney World or the Disney parks, but also Disney films, the repeated viewings, right? There's a lot of rituals around Disney. And then the third is community, which I know is something you speak about a lot here on your show, and what religious studies scholars call communitas, this sort of more oceanic kind of connected, electrified sense of community.
Awesome. This is a great way to start. And maybe we start by kind of unpacking these three different areas, if that works for you.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about story. How have you seen Disney and the church or religion use story to really bring people in, evangelize, and spread the word, and then keep people engaged?
Right. So as a religious studies scholar, I study a lot of different world religions, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism. And there's a real parallel between, for example, discussions of tradition in Disney and in Jewish culture, right, where tradition is very important. You've also got the way that stories are interpreted, right, and they're returned to. So if you look at a story like Cinderella or a story like Beauty and the Beast, when Disney comes through and they do the live action versions of those, right? First, they used to release the vault movies every 7 years or so, right? So each generation would be, you know, repeatedly, cyclically hearing the story. And that's very true in both Christian and Jewish and Muslim tradition. All three of those scriptural traditions have cycles of readings. Christians call it a lectionary. Jews call it the Torah reading cycle. In Islam, you know, verses of the Quran go around. They're read at certain times. And so this idea of returning to a core story at certain times of year with each generation is something that we see in a lot of world religions and that we see with Disney films as well. And the way people find themselves in those stories is also really vital.
I think that piece is just super interesting for us, like having worked in the parks, because I know there was always this discussion around like updating rides, right? Like I remember it was the biggest pushback when we got rid of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, because the story, the narrative that so many guests had told themselves was, right, my parents took me here, I had fond memories of this, and I connected in with that story. But I think what that nostalgia, that returning to that same story does, the problem with that is that the younger generations couldn't identify with that story. They weren't familiar with that IP. And so from a company perspective, we had to update it. But I'm curious, like, your take on something like that, like updating the story. Like, how does that go about?
Right. And that happens in world religions, too. Mr. Toad is a great example. It's an IP from the 1940s, I believe. And, you know, poor Mr. Toad, he's over in Haunted Mansion graveyard now. So that happens in world religions, right? So pull again from the Jewish tradition. There's something called Midrash, which is interpretive story. And it starts in the ancient world. It starts around the time that Christianity begins. Judaism also develops a lot of new things. And the rabbis would look at the stories in the Bible, which may be familiar to Christian readers as well. And they'd say, oh, look, there's a story in Genesis 22, Abraham almost sacrifices Isaac, right? Really core for many world traditions. And Sarah's not there. Isaac's mother's not involved. And even the rabbis, who were by no means feminists, were like, hey, where's Sarah? What's going on with Sarah? And they would write interpretations, essentially ancient fanfic, figuring out what's going on with Sarah. And then today, feminists ask what's going on with Sarah and write poetry about it in a different way. So there's always updating going on in quote unquote real religions. And I think that, you know, that's how the parks were intended to be, right? The whole idea of always plussing, always adding comes from Disney himself, was because they were alive. And the films get updated too.
It's so interesting. I get sticking with this story aspect of it, right? So for people that aren't as familiar with Disney or maybe have not thought about, obviously, my lens, having worked at the parks, is through the parks lens. So feel free, Jody, to add other pieces to this. But I think when we think about like this religious fanaticism around Disney, I tend to think about it and relate it to the in-person experience of going to Disney World. Is that similar to kind of like the way you think about it?
I'm thinking about it in both cases, but I think it's the most fun to think about in person because the way I study religion is very embodied. I'm interested in how people read children's books with their kids in their homes. I'm interested in how people make quilts that connect to their religious heritage. So I think that it happens with the films. There's a book called The Gospel According to Disney by a reporter named Mark Pinsky. And it's a little dated because it's from almost 20 years ago, but he goes through some of the earlier film and finds religious themes. But I think that the parks have such a powerful hold on people because their memories of them are often these, like, it's like an inside out, they're core memories. Right. They're things that people did often with family or with friends. And they are often like religious life cycles associated with major milestone events like coming of age or graduation or weddings. And so that's why it has such a powerful hold on people.
And it is interesting too. I mean, when you think about, you mentioned this word earlier, like you would make your annual pilgrimage down to Disney, right? I do think about this for bigger brands, right? Or sports teams that we do a lot of work with. The in-person experience is kind of that mecca pilgrimage experience, but you can engage with the brand, you can engage with the religion in 100 other different ways throughout the course of the year on your own time, in small groups, in your own communities, whatever it might be. But there is this larger pilgrimage mecca. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a Red Sox and Green Bay fan. So those are two different stadiums that have that kind of history around them. And I think you really see that language, you know, when people go to Fenway Park about its historicity and the same kind of pushback, right? When they did the big renovations and they put seats on the monster, some people said this is sacrilege. And it's very similar to what we see, especially with changes to Disneyland. Because it's the first park and it's a park that Walt touched. You know, and you'll notice Miss Toad is still there in Disneyland. I don't know what would happen if they got rid of me.
Yeah, that being the initial site, you're right. There's a lot more pushback that happens there. And so another like just kind of core religious sports experience for me. So I went to Notre Dame and it was very much like things that to me were just common sense. And from like a business perspective, I'm like, guys, why don't we have a Jumbotron? I went to the bathroom and I missed the touchdown. Oh, it's because that, you know, that's, we don't do that here at Notre Dame. That's not the story of coming to this historic bucket list item, this pilgrimage. And I'm like, yeah, but I missed the touchdown. Right. And so now they have that Jumbotron and there's updating of that story as well.
Absolutely.
I think one other thing to think about from a story perspective, and I'm curious from a religion aspect, your thoughts on this, but I know even the way that the parks were constructed, and it's what makes Disney so different than a lot of the other theme parks, is this way that story was constructed in the park building, right? So right away, you don't see the castle at Magic Kingdom because that's the climax, right? That's what you all come for. So there's a buildup to that, and there's a specific story as you walk through that physical journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something where I love to watch the opening day broadcast of Disneyland and think about what happens when you go under the train trestle that separates you. And it's demarcated, right? There's the famous sign, you know, here you leave the world of today. And you can't see the castle till you've really come out into town square and gotten a little bit closer. And that's what a religious studies scholar would call a liminal space. That moment, that's a linen just means threshold in Latin. And so the moment when you transition from the outside world into the Disney space, you're crossing this dramatic threshold. And I don't think there's anything else like it in amusement parks.
100% agree. Well, let's maybe talk a little bit about ritual. So obviously, huge thing in, especially in religion. And I think when we think about ritual, religion is the first thing that comes to my mind, where a story maybe is not the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about religion. Ritual, certainly. But just like with Disney and just like with sports teams, ritual is what kind of keeps people retained and engaged. So maybe talk to us a little bit about what you mean by ritual being one of the biggest parallels between fandom and religion.
Right. So rituals are embodied, repeated acts. People will sometimes debate, like, you know, well, you brush your teeth every day. Isn't that a ritual? But they're acts that have meaning. The ritual is actually what brings the story out into the world. And it's also how people go through life cycle passages. So in my research, one of the things I do is spend a lot of time on Disney fan websites and Facebook groups and watching how people talk about both happy and sad things at the park. So one couple gave me permission to talk about their story that they shared. They very tragically had a stillbirth. And then later they had two living daughters, but they lost their son. And every year, in memory of him on his birthday, they went to the parks and they did acts of kindness. They called them Aiden's Acts of Kindness for other families. And they would, you know, sometimes they brought little goodie bags, you know, or they did other nice things for people, what they call pixie dust. And they would take a picture of, it makes me cry every time I think about this story. They had mouse ears made for their child that they lost. And they would take a picture of the living children in front of the castle. There's one with them on the grass in front of the castle. And when I saw that, I just said, you know, this is so powerful, right? That family was also Christian, right? So when I say people are doing Disney in a religious way, it doesn't exclude the fact that they might belong to a recognized religious tradition. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But people are in the Disney parks because they matter to them. They're going there to mark time. They're going there to, you know, take pictures of their baby announcements, their proposals, right? They're getting wedding pictures by the castle. And so ritual in space is really, really meaningful. But it can be much more mundane things, right? There's people who have a certain spot where they always go to watch the fireworks. Or like, you know, we have Dole Whip after we ride this particular ride. In my own family, we have a treat. We have a tradition called Everest ice cream, where my husband sits on the ground feeling nauseous and my daughter and I go to the ice cream truck every time. Right. And I use that in my class with my students, and they forget everything else I tell them, but they remember that story because it's such an obvious example of ritual. And she gets mad. We can't ride Everest without the ice cream now, right? It's required.
But again, I mean, I like the way that you frame it about a ritual not just being an act that we do all the time. It's a repeated act that has meaning, a specific meaning assigned to it. And you're right. I mean, with Disney, the amount of people that make that yearly pilgrimage and they have that certain memory or association with it, right? Whether it's positive or negative, right? A lot of times positive, but like looking back at it, just the same as you can with religion, right? You could have a certain recollection or perception of how those rituals were and how they impacted you. But I think it's the fact that Disney allows for it and encourages and oftentimes creates an environment where fans can have those repeated rituals is what makes it also so rich, right? Like, how come more organizations, I mean, I think sports teams do a great job of this as well, but how come more organizations don't create an environment where rituals can really be enacted? Or why is Disney so good at that?
Well, I can say why Disney is so good at it, because Disney is so good at emotion, because story drives everything. So I think that the fact that people go every year, it's not always easy, right? A pilgrimage isn't necessarily all fun and roses, right? If people make Hajj to Mecca, right? It's hot, it's windy, it's also quite expensive. I think that the fact that Disney always wants you to be in the story, right? Like, they had this marketing campaign for the princesses a few years ago. And it was the Dream Big Princess marketing campaign. I use it in class all the time. I show my students some of the commercials where they intercut images of, say, like, Pocahontas is canoeing, and then they'll show a modern day girl live action kayaking, right? Or they'll show someone running, and then you see a girl running on a track and reading all these things. Much like saints, right? You know, people in, like, say, medieval Catholicism, modern Catholicism, right? There's all these different saints. They stand for different things. They're important. And they are associated with different traits. And we see that in so many religions. And so the idea that with the princesses, what they were doing was giving people qualities to latch onto. That's very much how the princess marketing has turned in the last, I'd say, 10 years or so. As they've gotten away from the sort of girly girlness and more towards action and agency. And the whole song, is literally says, like, you know, live your story. So I think the reason Disney connects to people so much as a brand is that they can see themselves in those stories, right? And it's not that people can't see their story in a sports team, right? I mean, I'm not even from New England, and I wept in 2004 when the Red Sox won. I wept. So of course people have personal connections with other industries, but because Disney is so capacious and has so many IPs now and so many stories, so many people can see themselves there.
Okay. So I want to go down two different paths here. One, I don't want to forget the personality, being able to see yourself in that story. I want to go down that rabbit hole, but first I want to ask this. So if we feel like maybe a sports team doesn't do as good a job connecting you into that internal or making you feel a part of the story, why did you weep when they won? Like, talk to us about your emotions through that.
I didn't expect to talk about the Red Sox so much. I have the zeal of a convert with the Red Sox. I should be a Mets fan like my dad and like my husband. I'm from New Jersey. You know, there's Queens connections. But in 1995, I was a senior in high school doing a summer program in Boston, and I went to Fenway Park for the first time. And the Red Sox were terrible at that game, terrible. And it was the old Fenway, and they lost. And everyone got up and cheered for a walk because they were losing, I don't know by how many runs. And in the eighth inning, people were cheering for a walk. And this actually gets to my points about Disney. It was the sense of community that, for some reason, I guess I, as a baseball purist, I was like, these are real fans. These are fans who don't leave in the eighth inning when their team is down, you know, and they keep cheering anyway. And it was the communitas that made me a really diehard Red Sox fan. And then scholars would call this post-memory. I read so much about the history and the curse that it was like it had happened to me, even though it hadn't. But that's the power of story, right? So certain sports teams, I think, have those amazing, compelling stories. I would argue the Red Sox are less compelling without that story. They're just bad this year. But but I think that, you can find it with other companies. I think Lego I know you had someone from Lego on. I didn't read that episode, but Lego is an interesting one. But I think that it's a little bit harder for people to see themselves in sports because most of us are not athletic, although we can discuss Run Disney if you like.
Oh, we could definitely go into Run Disney. So I have let's go down that rabbit hole too, because some of my favorite Disney stories that I don't know if I've ever told on this podcast, but that my stories that I cry are about Disney, Run Disney. So maybe we go into that, and maybe we'll just shed some tears together. But what I want to talk about this, going back to the story and personality and being able to see yourself in it. It's something that we talk about on the show a lot of times is that I think sometimes in sports, specifically in college sports, and I think this is a lot of brands, right? I was having this conversation with an alcohol brand yesterday about infusing more heart and personality into what they're externally showing, whether that be on social media or in the different personality. I think a lot of times we get caught up, we tend to get caught up in having something be really professional or having something be really architected and scripted. And because we have a brand image and a brand reputation to uphold. But sometimes when we filter it through all these things, we have all these checks, we tend to lose that heart and personality. Now, Disney's able to do both. But I think ultimately connecting people into that story and making them feel a part of it. I mean, I've never thought about the example of that the Disney princesses now all have unique characteristic traits. But even like, I know this from, I'm a big Disney pin trader and spent a lot of time on the inner workings of that business. And my dad was actually one of the initial creators of that coming from the Olympics. But from a Disney perspective, it's really interesting because you would have people that only wanted Tigger pins because they connected with that character, or they only wanted Aladdin pins because they connected with that character. And Disney found a way through story to connect personality and personify the brand according to however you wanted to identify. And I thought that was just super interesting. I think as it relates to sports, there's so many personalities that you have on your team that you can leverage a little bit more. But I don't know I know we're just riffing now, but like anything else that you want to add to that? And then maybe we go down around Disney rabbit hole before we talk about community.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think brand Disney is about community, but we'll get there. I think that pins are fantastic because they're amulet, right? They are like a little religious amulet. They're something you can hold. They're very small. I think I started collecting pins cause they fit in your suitcase so easily. And they are like little emblem, right? And so you can show your personality, right? I have my pin that has Doc from Snow White and it says, you know, trust me, I'm a doctor because I have a PhD. Right? And so that shows my personality. And I think pins also, they're like, sorry to use a Harry Potter analogy, wrong franchise.
No, go for it.
But they're a little bit like a port key. So yeah. So, you know, in the Harry Potter books, you have these port keys and they whisk you somewhere else. And what powerful objects can do is they might not like be the old boot that gets you to the Quidditch Cup, right? They might not be something that literally transports you, but they are like a mental key. They are something that, you know, you remember, okay, I got this pin on this trip, right? You know, the first time I went to Galaxy's Edge, I got this Batuu pin, right? And so there's so many ways that it just really is a powerful emotional thing. And that's also something that, to my understanding, right, Disney introduced the pins, but they took off in part in a sort of grassroots way, right? People just got really into pin trading. And then now you can buy your pin trading kits in the parks.
Yeah. And for insight, for those of you that aren't familiar with the story, I mean, where it really happened, it was around the year 2000. Pins initially came from the Olympics. That's something that they've been doing there for a long time. And so some of the Disney executives went down to the Atlanta Olympics. I think it was like 94. Saw how cool all the pin trading was down there, what that community was like at the Olympic Pin Trading Village. And they said, hey, we have so much IP. We could easily do that for the year 2000 as a celebration. And it was really supposed to be just for that year. But what you had was, and again, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, Disney cast members, you know, could be a custodian, could be a vice president, whoever is going to wear a lanyard of pins. And as a guest, you can walk up and say, hey, I see that pin is on your chest. Like, can I trade it? And you can trade any Disney pin for another Disney pin. Doesn't matter the value, as long as it's an official Disney pin. But they were going to take it away. But what they found was that a lot of the hourly cast members were like, I signed up for this job so I could, because I love people and I want to engage with people. And I'm just a custodian and nobody's going to talk to me now. And I had more fun in this last year because random guests were coming up to me and talking to me because I had cool pins on. And now I'm just going to be going back to getting ignored. And I don't want that. I want that community. I want that connection point. And so to your point around it being the pins being an amulet or a port key, I think it's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll add one more thing onto this. I've never thought about merchandise from that perspective. And I think it does. It applies larger than just pins. It could be that mug that everybody gets from Starbucks, right? It's why Starbucks does that, where they have the different locations on their mugs. And I think it's an interesting thing where people aren't using merchandise because there's some other type of brand. But if you're able to create those kind of connection points around key milestones, it could act like an amulet or a portkey to trigger that memory and create that emotional connection. It's really interesting.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk community, and maybe we start, like, give us communitas, what that means, and then maybe we get into Run Disney.
Right. So we have religious rituals. This is coming out of some like anthropology of religion. When you have people in a religious ritual, they often relate to each other in a different way. And the sociologist Emile Durkheim actually called this collective effervescence. The best example comes from sports, right? So collective effervescence, collective, all the people together. Effervescence, right? Something that's bubbly. Think champagne. Think, you know, a Coke can that you've shaken up. That's effervescence. It bubbles over, right? And, you know, obviously sports fans will be familiar with the feeling of, like, if you've ever been at a World Series game or a playoff game and the home team has hit a home run, then you have felt collective effervescence, right? You've felt this just unbelievable bubbling up of excitement that wouldn't happen with just one person or 10 people. But it can happen with 10 people. It's just, in that case, it's, you know, 40,000. So the way this happens in the Disney parks is particularly at the fireworks. I was at the 50th anniversary weekend last October, like as we hit the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World. And I didn't get into Magic Kingdom the first day. It was all like, you know, the park passes were up. But I got in the second day, October 2nd. So I saw the second ever showing of the new fireworks show, Enchantment. And the feeling on Main Street was unbelievable, right? People were so amped up and excited. Of course, the people behind me were also, this goes back to people not liking change and people, you know, criticizing change. The people behind me were also doing a long discourse on how it was different from Happily Ever After, and they weren't sure how they felt about it. But that said, yeah, it was, this is what religion is, right? One person might be feeling that one with the people, feeling that it's communitas. And someone else might be saying, you know, give me back Jordan Fisher. I want my old show back. And so I think but I think Disney really very carefully wants you to feel that, right? You know, that's why, you know, when the lights go down around World Showcase Lagoon and there's going to be either Illuminations or Harmonious, there's this sense of excitement in the air. And so that kind of effervescence is something that happens best in large groups, and it's the way that emotion is transmitted across the group.
Yeah. I think you're right. Disney really does want you to feel that. And this is something that we think about, like when it comes to self-motivation, right? And we had a guy by the name of Scott Rigby on the show, and he talked a lot about this, about our jobs as leaders is not necessarily to motivate our employees or our team members, is to create an environment where their self-motivation can flourish. And I think it's the same thing here from a Disney perspective. They can't create the community, right? But they can put things in place to allow the community to grow and foster. And I think it's the same thing with sports teams or any other brand. You can't force community to happen, but you can create an environment that allows that to happen. And what I mean by that with Disney, like we'll stick with the pin trading and then maybe we go into Run Disney. But like with pin trading, right, there's events that Disney will host for pin traders because they know that there's a lot of them. They know there's an active group. So they say, okay, how can we serve this group, bring this group together? Because we know that if the community is supporting each other, that is a larger sticking point. They're not just going to stick with our brand and continue to spend money based on our decisions. They're going to spend money and stay with the brand because of how they feel connected to this larger community. And so if you want to build on that with like actual terms or science or sociology study, but anyway.
Well, I think there's ways to talk about that with Run Disney, actually. Why don't we go there? So to explain what Run Disney is. So Run Disney is one of many arms of the Walt Disney Company. Began with the Walt Disney World Marathon. The first one was in the mid-1990s. It was the 25th anniversary in 2018. So I guess 93-ish, 94, around there. So that was when running was sort of in its second wave of becoming popular in the United States. Disney got into the marathon business too. But eventually it expanded, and now there are dozens of Disney races throughout the year. There are four big race weekends where people can go and run 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, and once a year a marathon in Walt Disney Parks. And it's been in Disneyland Paris. It used to be in Disneyland in California. And so it's a running company within the Disney portfolio. But what's so powerful about Run Disney, and I should say I'm a runner. I've done a Run Disney event. I ran my first marathon in Walt Disney World.
Love to hear it.
I'd love to talk about it. But it's running is also very religious, right? It's what we call a kind of asceticism. So when people hear the word asceticism, they picture like a monk in a desert, kind of going off in his cave and not eating. They think asceticism means deprivation. Asceticism is not deprivation. It actually classically means discipline. Asceticism means discipline. So running is an ascetic kind of discipline, right? Like to train for a race, you got to go do your miles, right? That's what you do. It's a discipline. And in that kind of discipline, there's another kind of really powerful meaning. But it's not just individual, right? This is why people run races, because you could go and run on your own, right? When I'm training, I mostly run on my own. But the Disney races, like the pins, just kind of took over and became so popular that people were bringing their own creativity to the Disney races in all kinds of ways. So, for example, you typically, except on Halloween parties, adults can't wear costumes in the park. For good reasons, but during very good reasons. But for Run Disney, you can dress in costume. And of course, to an outsider, to the Run Disney community, this is like, why would you run 26.2 miles, right? Dressed as Eve from WALL-E holding a plant. I'm not kidding. When I ran the Walt Disney World Marathon around mile three, one of my favorite costumes was clearly Eve from WALL-E. She was all dressed in white. She had the boot with the little plant. And I thought, oh my God, you're going to carry that for 26.2 miles. So why would you do that, right? For the power of community, right? I mean, people run for all kinds of reasons. And they are also very ritualized. But what happened with the Run Disney community is it just, I think, really blew up. So much so that it's very hard to get into the races now. I may or may not have just registered for one, and I was very lucky to get in.
Oh, they're like concert tickets. They sell out in 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So added context, this is such a weird podcast episode. Like I normally ask way more questions, but now talking with you, I feel like we could just riff for hours. So my dad actually ran ESPN Disney Wide World of Sports, was the longest has the longest tenure as an executive there. So Run Disney was part of his business. So I actually grew up I've never run a Disney event or a Disney marathon, but I have biked many, because for years my role at the Disney marathon was I was the guy at the very back.
You were the sweeper.
I was
the
sweeper.
One we all fear.
For years, I would do it. And so, again, some of my best stories and some of my worst, because there's so much. You could see everything that you just talked about. You saw it on like full display. I mean, there were people there that would be running, and just like side tangents here, there would be people running the full marathon. There actually were a lot less people were in much worse shape for the half than they were for the full. Because people thought, oh, I can just go out there and like run a half, and I can like, yeah, I trained and I ran like 3 miles one day, and so I could do a half. But nobody would ever do that for a full. So you would see people in these full costumes, and I'm like, how are you going to make it there? Like, what prompted you to wear this outfit when like you got no business being on this course? But people would stop and take pictures everywhere throughout the course, and I'm like, guys, I'm about to sweep you. I'm about to kick you off the course, but they got to get that picture because that's part of the story, being able to say that they were a part of that and that it connected to the community. But yeah, I mean, go ahead. Were you going to say something? Sorry.
No, I mean, I can tell a little bit of my own story if it's not.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Serious. I mean, I'm basically a cliche, right? I survived cancer and ran a marathon, which is like totally, yep. totally public. I've written about that in lots of public venues. The cancer part, not really the marathon.
Congratulations.
But I was training from, thank you. I've run two. And the first one was Run Disney because I had been training for my first half when I got sick. And I, you know, sort of vowed, you know, like walking around the hospital after my surgery, like, okay, I'm gonna run that marathon, right? Like I was doing laps, and this is what religions do and what Disney does, right? You can picture yourself in this kind of future that keeps people going, right? So I pictured a lot of things, including the New York Marathon and the Disney Marathon, and then I did it, right? And it was such a powerful experience. It was the 2021. Which actually technically I ran 25 miles for that marathon because it was so hot, it closed the course. The med tents were overloaded. So if you were a slower runner like me, you actually ran a little farther, but I ran another full. So I feel like it counts.
It does.
And so, you know, I put it on my shirt. I said, gosh darn it, I did this. I'm putting 1 year cancer free on the front of my shirt and on the back. This is so cheesy, but Frozen 2 had just come out and my friend made me a shirt and on the back, it was the line from do the next right thing. And it's like, take, you know, just one more step, one more breath, right? And do the next right thing. And so many people, because runners are like Disney fans are such a great community. Runners are such a great community. When you put them together, you know, the supportive feeling you get during a race like that, from other people coming up and tapping you and saying, you know, I love your shirt. You know, that is something that I don't think you can buy, right? Obviously, it costs a lot. You know, my family might beg to differ. It costs a lot of money to do that weekend. But I also, you know, raising money for charity. And that's a really powerful part of these stories is that, yeah Disney's a business, but it's also, you know, it's, there's a reason people do Make-A-Wish in Disney. And there's a reason, you know, they always are featuring stories of people who've come back from injuries and losses and all kinds of things. And what you do in these spaces is a way of writing your own story that is so powerful. And it really builds a community.
It really does. And I think you're right. And the lesson for me before we just keep going, I will tell one more story, but on Run Disney with what you just said about charity and there being a bigger cause, you running to celebrate being cancer free. I think the takeaway for a lot of brands is like, how can you invite people to participate? Because I think that's a big part of this is like, now you're not just consuming Disney for attractions. You have a story that you're creating by running in that marathon that again, Disney is allowing you to participate in. So I think if you're a brand, right, go and create some of those environments where people can participate and write their own story with your brand as a backdrop. But one of my favorite stories, I mean, I'll tell two quick ones or two or three quick marathon ones, just real quick. Cutting people was the worst part of my job at Disney because you would hear stories like that. And I'm like, you're still running too slow and I have to cut you. Right. Worst was mile 3. 1 year there was a veteran on walkers and she had gotten stuck in the porta potty. It's her 8th marathon. I had to cut her at mile 3 because she walked up a second too late and terrible. Another one, I had to cut a big group of people because they were getting paced by someone from Relay for Life and the Relay for Life pacer, her timer was off. And so they were all like, oh no, we're good. We're with the pacer. I'm like, gosh, she doesn't work for Disney. The pacer was also my 8th grade teacher. And I was like, David, is that you? I was like, somebody else got to cut these people. I got to move on. I can't be here. But there's so much emotion attached with that. But one of my favorite stories from it was all the people that you would meet who were running for a specific cause. And towards the end of the race, once we had said, okay, we're not going to cut any people, we'd get to like mile 18 or mile 10 if it was the half and say, we're not going to cut anybody. We're just going to help get them across. So the intro conversation, because those people, you're in the zone. Towards that end of that race, you're in the zone. So we'd walk up to them and you start talking to them and say, hey, you know, what's your, you know, why are you out here running this? This looks brutal. I would never do this. Like, what made you get out of bed and go race this? And you start to develop that connection point. And one of my favorites was somebody that had said their dad had passed away from cancer. And so she had told him before he died that she was going to get in shape and run this marathon. Hadn't trained much since he passed, but she said, I'm still going to run this thing. It was a half. And so I remember at the time, this is my dad's story, because I was right next to him, but he was the one talking to her. And he always tells the story and he always gets choked up during it. So he helped make sure that she got across. And she was the very last person to finish that race. And just sat with her, talked with her. She's got like blisters on her feet, getting her through. And we're kind of getting her through as a team. So I kind of rode my bike up ahead. And at that point, towards the end of the marathon, there's like nobody left, right? Like everybody's gone home. The cheering section's all gone. And there was a guy that wheeled up to me in a wheelchair and said, hey, are there any more runners? My wife was running the marathon and she is in the car with the kids, but I just thought it was really crappy that nobody else is here to cheer these people on as they finish, right? Talking about community and communitas. And I was like, yeah, we got one more runner. And he's like, do you think she'd mind if I wheeled in with her as she crossed the finish line? Mm-hmm. We were like, sure, go for it. And I always get choked up thinking about it, because like we were all just sitting there crying as like the community like crossed as the two of them, they hugged each other, they're crying. But yeah, I think you're right. Like, if there are ways that you can invite people in to create community with your brand, like that's the strength. That's when you can really get people connected in. But yeah. And so my dad tells the story because she wrote a letter a week later talking about how like the security guard was helping her cross the finish line. Like, little did she know, like, that's the guy that runs the whole thing. But anyway, it's story time. I'm off on a tangent, but anyway, community being a huge piece to that third parallel between religion and fandom. Well, somehow we're already like, we got like 5 minutes left and I don't know where the heck the time went. I talked on this way more than I probably wanted to, but let's jump in and just like last kind of questions here. I mean, what are some of the other like maybe specific demographics that you're studying more than others right now, or specific maybe trends even in the space?
Yeah, so a couple of things. You know, one is that I'm really interested in how Disney fans, I think, are becoming more diverse. So I am looking more at the adult Disney fans. I'm interested in people from different religions, different races, ethnicities, and how they tell their stories in the Disney parks, right? So I actually went to a Disney Institute Women's Leadership Summit back in 2019.
Heck yeah.
And it was because I had been searching for different religious Disney fan blogs, and I found one by a Muslim mom who was talking about finding places you could pray in Epcot, like where were places you could find a quiet spot. And one of them was actually Morocco, and because there were like prayer rugs in the store, I think, at that point. I haven't seen them more recently. And so I think I got a targeted ad because I had Googled Muslim and Disney, and that Disney Institute Women's Leadership Summit featured a picture of a woman from a previous summit wearing hijab, wearing a Muslim head covering. And so I said, well, I have to go to this. And it wasn't a specifically religious event, right? It was really about women's leadership and inspiration. But I found the diversity of people, the diversity of industries, they were fun, completely fascinating. And the way that, again, it was a space where people were telling their stories, right? The focus was really on like, what's your story as a business person? Like, you know, there's practical stuff about how to build your brand, and you learn about the five keys. And I think that's another interesting thing, is the way they've added the new key, right? They've added inclusivity. And when you look at the way they did it, at least in terms of the press release for it, right, the Disney Parks blog put up video, and like a religion, they always go back to the founder, right? So they intercut Disney's speech, you know, all are welcome here, and then they use the word welcome in introducing that new key, right? And so I think that there are ways that Disney as a corporate form does a lot of really powerful things. It's not to say it's still a business. It's still, you know, part of our economy. But I think that there's something really interesting in that culture there, in the women that I met at that event, although there was no one in hijab. Doesn't mean there weren't Muslim women. It just means no one was wearing a head covering. You know, so I'm really interested in that. I'm also really interested in places outside the park. So last summer, I drove to Marceline, Missouri. As soon as I was vaccinated, I got in a car and we drove to Marceline, Missouri from Pennsylvania to visit Walt Disney's hometown. And so this is not something that's officially affiliated with the Disney company. The Walt Disney Hometown Museum is a project of the town there. But I had met some of those folks at the Disney, you know, the D23 Expo. And what really struck me the most was that that was a site of a different kind of pilgrimage. The Disney fans would drive from all over to visit the museum. And I talked to this guy in the post office and he said, you really got to go see the farm site. You got to see where the farm was and where Walt's dreaming tree was. And so Disney had this tree, this cottonwood tree that he would sit under and sketch. And that's the symbol of the museum. And the guy in the post office was telling me about when they raised a barn there to look just like the barn that had been on the homestead and that had been in Disney's backyard where he made his trains. And I drove out there to the barn and it was this perfect day. And it was so quiet. It was so the opposite of what a Disney park is. You know, it sort of, I found myself thinking, well, the loudest, you know, some of the most exciting places in the world were born out of this silence. But in the barn, every single bit of wood was covered with signatures, just covered. Everyone who had come through had written something there, and they're encouraged to write on the barn, not the outside, just the inside. And they do the same at benches at D23. And you get a sense of just the enormousness of how many humans hold emotional stake in Disney. You know, for some people, that's like a religion. For some people, it's fun. Of course, religions can be fun, right? And for some people, it's history, family. But I was just so struck that, you know, this really kind of hard to get to spot in Missouri. It's not on an interstate. You got to take some smaller roads. Was just filled with signatures. And I think that was one of the most powerful moments of my research, one of the ones I'm using to open up the first chapter of the book.
I love it. And it goes to show too that there's layers to this fandom or fanaticism or religiousness, if you will. And I think if you, as a brand, if you're not cultivating all the different levels, you're really leaving something to be desired. There's a cap, there's a ceiling on how deep people can go. And that's a prime example where that's even out of Disney's scope per se. They don't have the direct influence on that town, but that's where it all started.
How are we doing on time? I know we're at 201. You have a couple extra minutes or we got to shut it down?
I can do till 205, 210, and then I'm fully out.
Then we're out. Okay.
Okay. Weekend thing. Yeah.
Awesome. Sounds great. And we'll cut this part. Yeah. Okay. So one more thing on before we leave here. I know people are trying to welcome new fans in. One thing I want to think about is for big fan groups, I mean, how can you create an environment that feels inclusive if people don't know the rituals, if people don't know the story without making them feel excluded? Because I think from a church perspective, even that can be intimidating. I go in and they're doing a hymn or a prayer that I don't know, and everybody else around me is reciting it. How do they do that? Same thing happens for us with sports teams. How do you think about creating those rituals, creating fandom, but not being exclusive?
Yeah, I think that's a great, fantastic question. I think that the biggest thing, and this is something I do in the classroom, I think one of the biggest things is actually transparency. Is explaining what you're doing and why, right? Because all groups have a kind of in-groupness to them, you know, or if you're a college student, right? Why is my professor making me read this book? It seems boring. Why has she done this to me, right? I think that when you create an explanation for why you're doing the ritual, that really helps, you know? And so I'm thinking some of this can happen on social media, right? Of course, it assumes that the new people are on social media. But I think that, you know, Instagram stories that give you a snippet of history that tell you about, you know, why do we sing Sweet Caroline in Fenway Park? You know, those kinds of things will reach some people, especially younger people who are on if it's TikTok or the right social media channel. I think the other thing is something that Disney actually does really well, which is that they tend to explain why they're doing what they're doing, right? Like, I mean, I think this is in the area of customer service. This is something a lot of cast members will do is like, you know, explain, well, this is for your safety or, you know, this is for whatever other reason, right? There's a lot of actually fairly explicit instruction there. So it's hard because companies don't actually completely control fan culture, right? As we've been discussing, the fans build the fan culture, the company lays the seeds. And the same thing happens with religion, right? You know, what a minister or priest says might not be what their congregants actually want to do. But I think that the more that anyone in a leadership role or a public facing role is really transparent about why things are happening. It's like, it's not rocket science. Like, tell people why you're doing what you're doing. I think it goes a long way.
I love it. I think that's probably a great place to end us. Jody, any final words of advice? And if not, where can people find you?
Last word of advice is lead with empathy. That's why I got into the religion business, is because maybe it's naive, but I thought people would get along if we understood each other's differences better. And I think Disney is an interesting site for thinking about that. People can reach me on Twitter. I'm at JEICHLERLEVINE, and I have a professional website that's just my full name.com.
And we will link to both of those in the show notes so that anybody can easily find you and interact with you. Well, Jody, I know you got to jump, but we could have talked for hours. I love spending time with you and can't wait to interact with you on Twitter. So thanks so much again.
Thank
for coming
you so
on.
Much. This was a pleasure.
Sounds good. And thank for everybody you. Tuning in, thanks a lot. We'll see you later.
Hey, guys, before you head out, just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. That helps more of your peers find the show as they search for ways to get better in their own roles. But this podcast is just a small part of what we do at Engagement. In our normal day in the office, we're crazy focused on helping athletic departments and sports and entertainment companies generate more revenue by becoming more customer-centric. To see how we might be able to help your organization, visit engagementpartners.com to learn more. Download a free guide, check out our blogs and case studies, or schedule a call with us if you want to see how we can help with your particular objectives. Our goal is to help you create deeper connections with fans and generate more revenue. So when you're with us, hopefully you find a nugget or two that helps your cause.